You probably can't go wrong writing a novel that is set in part on Alcatraz Island. That damp island in San Francisco Bay was home to the country's best-known federal prison for years, and it still retains the ability to focus the imagination. Today's guest used hers to weave Alcatraz into a novel. Add in Ireland, vaudeville, and Ellis Island, and we could not resist talking to Christina McMorris. She's the author of the book The Edge of Lost. Christina McMorris is the author of three previous novels with a pile of book awards to show for them. She lives in the Portland area and joins us from there. Welcome, Christina.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Very much a pleasure. Your first three novels were set around World War II. Tell us about your fascination with that period in history.
Right. Well, you know, I was always fascinated, I guess, with the music and love the fashion like a lot of people do. But it wasn't until I went to visit my grandmother, who on my mother's side, who lives up in Hoodsport, Washington, so just on the Olympic Peninsula. And I was visiting her for the weekend, had decided to put together a Christmas cookbook for the family, which a lot of families, of course, do, including some of her favorite recipes she'd collected and created over decades, and almost at the last minute decided to put in a biographical section about her life, thinking the grandkids would all love that when we make copies at Kinko's. And this was about 10 years ago. She ended up sharing things about her life that up until then she hadn't shared before. And of course, as you know, with that greatest generation, what's so amazing and humble about them is, and funny, is that when you ask, why didn't I know this, Grandma? She says, well, nobody asked. So, of course, I started asking. And what came about in that conversation was the fact that she and my late grandfather, whom I was very close to, he passed away about 20 years ago, that they had only dated twice during World War II, had exchanged letters the entire time, fallen in love through those letters, got married before the war was over, and were married for 50 years until he passed away. And so she pulled out of her closet then the whole collection of letters that nobody in the family knew she had. And we spent the afternoon poring over these beautiful yellow wrinkled pages that an 18-year-old sailor wrote that didn't know he'd be coming home tomorrow. And they were just beautiful. And when I left her house, I was not a creative writer at the time, and I thought, wow, this would make a great movie. This would be like The Notebook meets Saving Private Ryan. And I thought, what if you threw in a Cyrano de Bergerac twist? Because how well did she really know him through those letters? What if there were, you know, falsehoods in those pages? And you really wouldn't know until they were married. And so I just kind of ruminated on that thought, thinking it'd be a great film for somebody else to make. And a few years later, I was pregnant with my second child, so I joke that I thought I was superhuman. I was creating life, so a book didn't seem that hard. And I dove in and started writing this story as a novel and realized how little I knew and how much I needed to learn, and wrote many, many drafts of the book until it was finally published, which became my first novel, which was Letters from Home. So that is where the whole thing started.
And so with The Edge of Lost, you finally move away from World War II for the first time. It opens in 1937, so you didn't move terribly far in time.
True. Isn't this funny? I thought I was stretching my wings by delving away from the 40s. And actually, the story, as you know, jumps back even to 1919. So, you know, the story does begin in 1937, as you said, on Alcatraz Island, where the young daughter of a prison guard goes missing, and the a convicted bank robber is the only person who knows where she is, and he's keeping that secret for a very specific reason. But then it does jump back in time to 1919 Dublin, and I had to learn quite a bit about Ireland at the time, and then Brooklyn during the 20s, and the, you know, leading up to that stock market crash and the mobsters and Prohibition, and a lot of fun things that were very fun to research.
Well, I was about to ask, since you're not dealing with World War II anymore, the plots don't have events so much dictated by world events, but you still have to know a fair amount about the times in which you're writing.
Absolutely. And the things that I didn't plan on were, you know, where the story took me, as far as, you know, this Irish immigrant coming to Brooklyn and having to study the streets and of Brooklyn at the time, and how all of those different cultures mixed and did not mix. And then you got into the speakeasies, which, of course, was very fun. But, you know, it opens your eyes to a lot of behind-the-scenes secrets that happened at the time, reading a lot of memoirs. And then when you got into vaudeville and burlesque and the comedians that would entertain at that time around the country, that was a whole other section of history that I had never learned about, and it was fascinating. Every time I came across a nugget that I thought, oh my gosh, this is too funny or stranger than fiction, I had to weave it into the story somehow.
Well, I noticed the descriptions of the locations and life in the 1920s in Dublin and Brooklyn really bring out the grittiness of those places. They're pretty far removed from what life is like there today. How do you get to that level of immersion?
you know, the best thing, because I visited there quite a bit, of course, which always helps, but what I found the most helpful, aside from documentaries, was really reading those memoirs, because those were written from people that really remember what it was like, whether it is exactly spot on with fact or documentation. You know, you can debate that, but it is their memories of how it happened. And so reading several of those at a time, being able to find those commonalities between them was really helpful.
So was Alcatraz the irritating sand that started this pearl?
It was. Oh, goodness. I had no idea what I was in for, just like my grandmother's letters. Had no idea that it would suck me into a different world. What happened was I had always been fascinated by Alcatraz, as many people are. Had taken a tour there about a decade or so ago, and that always stuck with me. And when I was thinking about that as a possible setting for a future story, I came across a documentary online titled Children of Alcatraz. And it was about the kids that had grown up on the Rock as the family of the prison staff. So I was very surprised to learn that there were about 300 civilians that lived there at one time. And the kids would actually take the prison boat launch across the bay and go to school every day rather than you would think the parents would commute. And so I thought, wow, you know, this would make a really great nugget of a story for a novel, because in the documentary, the gentleman on there had said that he'd actually secretly befriended even Robert Stroud, the Birdman of Alcatraz.
Wow, all kinds of stuff to learn about with Alcatraz and Ireland and Ellis Island and the other settings of Christina McMorris's novel, The Edge of Lost. We'll come back and talk more with Christina. If you'd like to join us on The Exchange, we'll take your phone calls and emails as well. Back on the program in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Portland area author Christina McMorris. Her fourth novel is out now. It's called The Edge of Lost. Boy, it's a little hard to describe, but it involves Alcatraz Island in the 1930s, Dublin in the 1920s, and Brooklyn and Ellis Island at that time as well. And a bunch of interesting characters we'll get into. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about settings, themes, historical treatments. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Christina, we were just talking about Alcatraz and the fascination with it. How thoroughly did you research Alcatraz? It sounds like with the map alone, it got fairly intense.
It did. It did. You know, I went through all of these fantastic books and memoirs and historians that had gone through Alcatraz and done so much of my work for me. Thank goodness for them, that people that had spent 10 years working on these books. And I was able to just post it the heck out of these books and highlight them to death and really use them and the authors as resources. Some of them were just kind enough to answer a zillion of my questions, including park rangers there as well, until they just couldn't take me anymore, I'm sure. But, you know, you have to ask the people that know, because I always think, you know, the last thing they want to do is read a book and say, that's wrong. So I ended up ultimately, when I felt enough research and knew where the story was going with Alcatraz, I did take a night tour there. I'd already done the day tour, but went back for the evening, and it was amazing to be there with a completely different experience in the night, as you can imagine.
I understand you actually spent some time thinking about ways to escape Alcatraz.
Gosh, yes. It was so funny. I remember, I'm sure you remember in the movie Apollo 13, when they sat in the room, the engineers, and they threw all those items on the table and said, this is what they have up there. Now, put them together in some way and make sure they live.
Fix their air, yeah.
Right? They find this is all you've got to work with. And that is exactly how I felt. I sat in my room alone with those books and the maps and the time frame and what rules were in place at the time, how the inmates had tried to escape soon after my story, because it's, you know, there is an escape attempt that happens in the book, of course, but you don't know exactly who it is that's trying to escape. And I had to work within those confines of what would be plausible that the person could actually do that.
So you talked about the starting point for the book is the disappearance of one of the 300 civilians on Alcatraz Island. A little girl disappears, and Tommy Capello, this inmate, is the only one who knows what happened to her. How is it that he's the only one who knows?
Well, that's giving away quite a
bit.
I
didn't want to give away the back of the book, but yeah, if you can give us a hint.
You got it. Well, there is an acquaintance that the two of them make, and there actually is a friendship that forms, but there are a lot of things that go wrong. And so because of that secret friendship that is very innocent, and you know, you can imagine in the dark, dank walls and confines of Alcatraz, finding a child who is, you know, so innocent and sweet and finding the good, and also a very broken soul. And so you have this connection that the two end up making, but unfortunately that friendship will end up changing the course of both their lives in good and bad ways.
All right, so you say the documentary about Alcatraz inspired the book. It's obviously, but then it goes back to 1919 in Dublin. So you really put Alcatraz at the end of the story, but the beginning of the book. Tell us about the decision-making process that drives those sorts of choices.
Yeah, well, I can say probably the most honest answer is I saw that opening scene of a girl missing and a convict who actually knew where she was. When there was a big search on the island, you would think it's for him, and yet there is something more in play. And I saw that from day one. So for me, I typically see my books as a film in my head. I was much more of a movie buff than a reader before I started writing, and so I see it very visually. And so I wrote that scene because I had to get that on paper. It was just too exciting to write, not to write. And then I had to think, how did they get to that moment? So I guess you could say in some ways there's films like Swordfish or Goodfellas where, you know, they have that climactic scene that they show first, and then it just piques your interest, I think, and it backs up and shows you how that the journey got the viewer and those characters to that moment, and that's how I wrote the story.
I notice it gets used a lot in TV shows now, too. You know, something really extraordinary happens in the first couple of seconds, and then you get the fade to black, and 10 days earlier.
Right, absolutely. But, you know, you're sucked in, aren't you? You know, you kind of sometimes, I think, if you have that kind of slower beginning, it's nice, I think, to have something, that climax that you think, how did they get there? And actually, the way that they get there may be very different than what you think.
Christina McMorris, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Portland area author, the author of a new novel called The Edge of Lost. It's her fourth novel. 5,000 miles, then, from Dublin to Alcatraz. It's a three-decade-long journey in The Edge of Lost. It feels like a journey of many metaphorical miles. I mean, so primarily, was it the places and times that interested you, or the themes and relationships, or something else that drove the writing?
Yeah, I think it's both. You know, there were a lot of Italian immigrant families that are in the story, as you know, Irish immigrants as well, which, of course, is so relevant today as well. The fun part about the Italians was that I was fortunate to live in Florence, Italy during my college years. And so I drew a lot on the people that I knew there and the families and the mothers that insisted that you just never ate enough. You know, they were always, as soon as you finished your meal, they were cooking the next one. So I got to, and the fact they treated wine like water, you know, it was not something to get intoxicated with. It was just part of the meal. And there's so many things I love about that culture. And so it was fun to be able to weave those in. That was definitely a driving force for sure. And other than that, it was really these settings I was so excited about writing, because you get something gritty like those steamships coming over to Ellis Island and the queues that run, you know, for miles, and like they said, the Brooklyn streets. And then you get into those vaudeville shows that were so fascinating, had completely their own culture and their own slang and everything else about them that happened behind the scenes. And that becomes very fun to share with people.
So let's talk about the bridge then between Ireland and Ellis Island, and it's the person of Shanley Keegan, who is this vaudeville performer. Ellis Island is still a busy place in 1937, it turns out.
Yes, absolutely, very much so. And I know even on my grandparents, my mother's side, you know, I had always grown up with the stories of the fact that their last name was changed on Ellis Island when they came through because of spelling, and a lot of them, you know, were illiterate. And then you also had a story of my grandfather, the fact that he was dark Irish and had the olive complexion and black wavy hair and brown eyes, and he could easily pass as Italian. And so I love the idea that you had all these immigrants coming through from all different walks of life and cultures and languages, and very scared about what they were facing when they got there, even though their hopes were so high for a better life. And yet they could just as easily be put on a ship and sent right back if they were not deemed fit to stay.
Well, let's talk about Shan then, because here he is passing as Italian, living in a culture different from his own, but never loses his sense of self, really.
Yeah.
Which is a little surprising for somebody who would make that change at a relatively young age.
Yeah, absolutely. I think because I like the fact that he was almost 12 years old when the story began, so he is not, you know, 4 or 5 years old. A lot of I thought his self, the deep down core of him is already formed because he had such an amazing mother and really formed who he was from that. From there on, I loved that outside of that core, there are so many things that could have changed him. And although it changes him a bit, it doesn't ruin him. And so that outside, you know, surface, that what is going on the outside, as you know, for survival, he becomes a chameleon in so many ways.
Give us an idea of the timeline. Does he get into vaudeville and performing first? Does he become a chameleon through that process? Does he become a chameleon by bypassing his Italian and then get into vaudeville?
Right. Well, in the beginning of the story, you know, he's in the Dublin pubs, and that is how he ekes out a living for a pretty horrible uncle who has taken him on. He's found the kid to be pretty lucrative in that you can take him into a pub, and he has learned by listening to gramophone records at the time, it were so popular, of these comedians from America that were vaudevillians, that were great at imitating voices and accents and jokes, and he learns to copy them by listening to them over and over and over again. It's his way of escape, and he learns it makes people laugh, and the fact that it makes people laugh, of course, you know, draws out not only funds of shillings at the time and free meals very often, but also trust from other people. And so he uses that in order to get through Ellis Island, to get to Brooklyn, but it's not really until later in life when there are some unfortunate things happen that in his life that he has to learn how to survive on his own again. And he falls back on the one talent that he has, which, of course, is imitating others, being someone else.
We're talking to Christina McMorris about her fourth novel called The Edge of Lost, which involves Alcatraz Island, Ireland, and Dublin, and Ellis Island as well, among other scenes in the books. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Did you know anybody like Shannon? I guess, for that matter, you know, looking at the important characters in the book, I kind of gave up counting at 13. These are all pretty well-developed individuals who move the plot forward. I mean, did these all have to spring from inside you, or are your friends calling you saying, hey, I'm in your book?
Right? I think most people, hopefully, they won't end up in the book and as a bad character. You know, you always say, you know, you joke and say as a writer, you know, be nice to me or you'll end up in my next novel and it won't be pretty. So I actually have a T-shirt that says that. It's fantastic. I just try to remind my family of that at all times. So I think, as most writers, I'm sure, do take bits and pieces probably of myself and other people around and not even realizing how much we use, I think, of the people around us. But I've always loved the Irish culture. I've visited several times. I've grew up, you know, being in love with that brogue, as most people are, and just the musicality of how they talk and the politeness but also the gruffness of those streets and the survivor instinct that they really truly have. So being able to weave that into that character was very fun.
One of the favorite parts of the book is how Shan got revenge on a competing comic named Patty.
Yeah, Patty O'Hooligan. Yeah, one of my favorite parts. You know, you've got, as you said, he's a comedian on at that time than the burlesque circuit rather than vaudeville, and there is a comedian there who is passing as an Irishman with a very heavy brogue, so heavy that it actually sounds more like a Scotsman. And Shan just, you know, they become a bit of rivals. And the fact that Shan is actually the Irishman who is not passing, who is passing as Italian, I found there's some fun irony in there.
The immersion in vaudeville itself, and it's still a little hard to understand what vaudeville is because it was gone so long, I guess, by the time most of us got on the scene. I would assume that broadcasting and movies, sound movies, ended up doing vaudeville in.
Yeah, absolutely. It was radio that did it in first, and of course, because, you know, you had the, especially as it got into the rough years in the Depression era, the 1930s, especially after the stock market crash in 1929, so few people had money to start to go to those shows anymore. These variety one acts that we are now accustomed to seeing on, say, you know, America's Got Talent was so similar to that idea, or these one acts that were even like Saturday Night Live. And you had people that before could pay a dime to go sit in the top balcony and watch shows all day long. And yet, when you couldn't afford it anymore, or also, when the radio presented itself, you now had a free show for all of those one acts that they, Bob Hope and everyone else, would be on the airwaves and give to you for free. And so it definitely started the decline of vaudeville, which was very glorious for quite some time. And then a lot of those comedians were out of jobs and started going to the burlesque circuits instead, which was seen as a step down, and yet it was very lucrative because people were much more willing to go out and see women removing garments than they would be to see a poodle doing some flips on the stage.
So the poodles were out of work, but the comedians managed to hang on.
Yes, absolutely.
So I did get the feeling that there must have been just thousands and thousands of vaudeville performers then to fill all of the theaters around the country.
Yeah, well, I think that there was the decline, though, as you know, as we said. I think originally, yes, you had so many kids growing up in families that would perform as families. And so these kids grew up doing tap dances and, you know, musical numbers and really lived on the road. And they were, a lot of those kids who became very talented became the breadwinners in the family. And so I think you had a lot of, especially immigrants, you know, that really that was their talent. You know, it was either that or doing very labor-intensive work and trying to find work. So they did travel around, as which I thought was amazing and sad, a hard life for sure. You know, when you were constantly jumping on buses and trains and living in hotels, and that was their whole life.
Talk about the cinematic aspects of, since you mentioned thinking in terms of movies as you write things down, or used to anyway. Is there an attempt to recreate some vaudeville stuff there in the book?
Yeah, absolutely, because I watched some documentaries, and again, you find things that were just, you can't make the stuff up, and, you know, where you have guys that were passing always as German, you know, German immigrants with thick accents and beer steins, and yet they were Hungarian Jewish men, and so I ended up, you know, stealing a bit from history because it was just too good not, you know, to pass up. You know, you've got George M. Cohen, who actually appears in the book, and at the time, I'm embarrassed to say, I wasn't familiar even with his name until I came across it several times and realized, of course, it was, you know, that his life story was, you know, in a fun way, was put on screen. As when I was a kid, I remember growing up and seeing Yankee Doodle Dandy and it being about his life and all these songs that he had written, like, you know, Over There and I'm a Yankee Doodle Boy. And I thought, oh my gosh, how have we forgotten, so many of us forgotten, who some of these amazing, very talented people are that we are still singing their songs today. And so it was fun being able to put those real characters as cameos in the story.
Christina McMorris is our guest on The Exchange. Her latest novel is The Edge of Lost. So we just talked about George M. Cohan and some of his cleaner stuff. Some of vaudeville got fairly raunchy, didn't it?
Yeah, well, yes.
Even without it turning into burlesque.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I've heard a little bit of that, but more that I really heard was the fact that because there were kids there as well, that a lot of those one acts really then transferred perfectly to radio, and then that went on to becoming, you know, to television, you know, like the Lucille Ball shows and et cetera. And so much of our primetime TV now all really stems from those vaudeville shows. And you know, if you talk about raunchy, I guess that really kind of has come full circle. It's kind of amazing sometimes what is put in regular TV and even in daytime TV today.
So let's shift and talk about some of the ethnic background here in the book. We're talking about Shanley Keegan, one of the main characters who passes as an Italian man. These are not groups of people who were completely restraint free. Let's put it that way. When they first arrived in America,
right? As far as the immigrants, is that what you're referring to?
Right. Yes. Irish and Italians took a pretty hard, almost a beating in physical terms from other ethnic groups.
Absolutely. And I always, you know, we kind of joke in our house about the fact that, you know, we've got the whole Irish side. My husband is also Scotch-Irish. And so, you know, we joke that my father's an immigrant from Japan, which is also, by the way, where I drew a lot of the immigrant experience from in this story. But we joke about the fact that, you know, we're diluting the Asian bloodline, you know, and filling it with more Irish with our kids, and how St. Paddy's Day in our country has become, you know, such a fun holiday that everybody wants to be Irish on that day. You know, you wear the green and show off the fact that you're Irish on a certain holiday, where not that long ago, you know, the last thing you wanted to be was Irish. And I found that fascinating as well, reading in the memoirs how there was really that hierarchy of immigrants. So sort of the lowest of the low, you know, even had a pecking order.
You talked about your father immigrating from Japan. Did he spend any time? Actually, he would have been too young to come from internment camps, I would think. But any internment camps in your family?
No, not in my family, thankfully. What happened was my father was actually born, strangely enough, on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. So it was, he was born on December 7th, but in 1949. So it was soon after the war. And he came over when he was 19 years old. And even then, which I find so interesting, is that when a war had not happened that long ago, world war between the countries, that he still grew up thinking that America was an amazing place and wanting to go there. That was his dream. And so he did come over with speaking very little English and lived in a car for some time and taught karate lessons in order to go to college and stay, you know, stay housed and fed and really live the American dream.
Much more to talk about with Christina McMorris. Her fourth novel is called The Edge of Lost. It starts out in Alcatraz. It takes us back to Ireland many years previous and a lot of places in between. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back to the program with Christina McMorris and your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the Portland area author Christina McMorris. She has written three novels before now, Letters from Home, Bridge of Scarlet Letters, The Pieces We Keep, and now The Edge of Lost is her fourth novel. And it starts at Alcatraz Island in 1937 with a missing person and goes back in time to Dublin in 1919 and traverses through Brooklyn and Ellis Island and a bunch of other locations you might recognize. Talks about vaudeville and Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants and Irish immigrants passing as Italian immigrants. There's a lot going on in The Edge of Lost. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the circumstances and the directions of the characters. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You know, I hadn't thought about this when we were talking about vaudeville, Christina, though, about the fact that a good bit of the book takes place during Prohibition. And it's just hard to remember that there was all this drinking going on and a lot of crime related to it as well at a time when drinking was supposed to be illegal, or at least the sale of alcohol was supposed to be illegal.
Right, yeah. I was amazed to find out even more. I knew bits and pieces of history surrounding that just from my research of World War II. But as I was reading these books of the well-intentioned, you know, laws that were entailed with Prohibition as far as you not being able to manufacture and sell and distribute alcohol at the time, even though technically drinking was not against the law, which I found funny, just mainly frowned upon, but you had to get it from somewhere, even if it meant the Italians were fermenting it in their basements. Literally, you could smell it as you walked past their apartments, they said. So it was an interesting time to read about because you did have this well-intentioned law, and yet what it caused, unfortunately, was a major spike in the drinking at the time because suddenly the forbidden sounded very fun. And then you had thousands of speakeasies that popped up almost overnight.
And again, the crime that went with that, and there's so much fascination with the criminals of that time. I guess it's surprising to me still that people still seem to know the name of Al Capone.
Yeah, isn't it true? And even the kids' books, you know, that are Al Capone, you know, does my shirts and whatnot. I think that there is very an interesting sort of romanticized view of those mobsters, which and also just it's captivating, I think, to watch these guys who were criminals and yet so dapper and really ran it as a business, but a ruthless business. And there was a very ugly side to it as well.
Al Capone himself takes us back to Alcatraz because he did spend time there, didn't he? Give us an idea of what you found out about his time there.
Yeah, well, what I found out was that, which makes, of course, complete sense once I read it, was that he was not very well liked by many of them. Imagine how many grudges that he had formed over the years, you know, with rivals, and he was the king of the crop at one point, and yet now he's in Alcatraz wearing jumpers, you know, jumpers with the rest of them. He did go literally insane when he was at Alcatraz. because of illnesses. And so there was a time, apparently, that he would meet with people early on and be okay and play his banjo for fun, and yet there was a steady decline in his mental health to the point that he had to be isolated from the rest of them and then eventually sent away. But one of the funniest stories I came across involving Capone was that he apparently took cake in the mess hall at lunch or dinner one day and did not eat the outside edges of his cake. And apparently the food was fantastic, which surprised me as well, because they were feeding so few inmates. There were only about 250 there at a time. And so the food was generally very good, and yet you could take as much as you wanted, but you had to eat every bite. It was a very strict rule from Warden Johnston. And apparently he did not eat the outside edges of his cake, and so he was given a written formal reprimand and also punished the next day.
Really? This Al Capone ended up getting a reprimand for not eating the outside of his cake.
Right. It sounds like a five-year-old being, you know, punished by his mother. And another funny story relating to him is that you could also get magazine subscriptions in there if you could afford them. And they had to be approved, of course, by the warden. But if you were generous, you could come up with a list of names of all your inmate buddies that you would then pass that magazine on to, which was such a prized possession at the time for the outside world. And so you would know if Capone was mad at someone because he would scratch their name off their his subscription list.
Wow. Al Capone, the news dealer.
Exactly.
Alcatraz itself, I mean, when you've been there a couple of times now, it sounds like day tour and night tour, and I've been around it on the Bay Cruise, but not on it myself. It looks really fascinating from a distance. How much grimmer does it look than when you're on the island looking at the civilization that you can't possibly reach across that cold water?
Yeah, well, it looks so close, and like you said, it's so far away with that cold, icy water, the fast currents, the wind blowing, the rain pouring down. Sounds like Oregon weather at the moment.
Right.
You know, and the birds constantly cawing enough to make you crazy. And there is a definite feel, and anybody I'm sure can attest to this that's been to Alcatraz, of a history that you feel in the walls, just the kind of a sadness, more than to me a creepiness, about being in those cells. It is very, very bleak, and when you're there, what's amazing is you can take a self-guided audio tour. When I first took that many years ago, I laughed because it was a Walkman at the time that you had to stop and pause, and now it's an iPod, which is so much nicer. It tells you how long it's been, I guess, between my visits. But what's neat is you actually are listening to voices of guards and some inmates that were there, and they have the sound effects of, you know, feet and boots walking down the corridors, and so you close your eyes and they have you sit in a cell by yourself and listen, and you're given sounds as if you were there during the time.
Wow. But you mentioned 250 inmates, and then earlier you said something like 300 family members on the island, or
right.
Civilians?
Right. Isn't that amazing? You had more civilians there at one time than even inmates. And what was amazing to me was that there were only 250 or so inmates. I was surprised to learn that. I guess I always figured it was higher than that. With this, as well known as Alcatraz is, you know, it was really meant as the end of the line for people who were inmates who were too hard to handle at other prisons or were considered high escape risks. And so then past those inmates, you had actually 80 guards to 250 inmates, which was only a 1-to-3 ratio, which is unheard of at the time for other prisons.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so lots of families on there. Now, you mentioned the students commuting off the island to get back to San Francisco to go to school. So they were the ones that got on the boats in the morning. Obviously, lots of opportunities to get onto boats there, but not for prisoners. So lots of escape attempts over the years, a few here and there?
Yeah, there were 14 official escape attempts, and the stories were amazing. I mean, these guys were very smart, many of them, to even end up there in the first place. You know, not quite smart enough, apparently, but enough that they had robbed many, many banks and, you know, committed a lot of crimes since their childhood to finally end up at Alcatraz. And so some of the escape attempts were pretty amazing. There was one, actually, that did spend 10 years, imagine that, collecting one piece of clothing at a time out of the military laundry that he worked at on the docks so that he could complete an entire tech sergeant uniform. And after 10 years of doing this, he had over 40 pieces of you know, items to put on. He threw them on one day, jumped on that prison boat launch with other military guys, and unfortunately he was recognized as being unfamiliar on the boat very quickly, and his absence was noted on the docks pretty fast. So by the time that he made it just barely across the bay over to another fort, they grabbed him immediately, and he was turned right back around to Alcatraz after 10 years of attempting this one escape.
Wow. That took a lot of work.
Yeah, that was a lot of determination. You know, one other one that I'll share with you, which I found very fun, which was Pretty Boy Floyd, known as mm-hmm. the getaway driver, of course, for Bonnie and Clyde. He ended up attempting an escape, and he crawled all the way down to the shoreline and got into the dark caves right down below the mat shop where they would discard tires that they used for the Navy. And two other guys tried to escape with him. One was shot and killed. The other was recaptured. Pretty Boy Floyd ended up hiding out under tires in these dark caves, and for 3 days he stayed there, to the point that the search ended officially. They were still looking, of course, but the major search on the island had ended, and the warden actually released a press statement saying he was shot and killed in the water. He had drowned. And so finally, Pretty Boy Floyd couldn't take the hypothermia, the hunger, and the snapping crabs that kept him awake all night anymore, and apparently he thought Alcatraz was better than this, and he climbed back up into the Model Industries building right above where they would work and waited to be found. So I imagine there was some backpedaling with the press of, having to say, oops, I guess we were wrong.
Yeah, the resurrection of Pretty Boy Floyd.
Right.
Must have been a great headline.
Definitely.
So given all the stuff you ended up amassing, I mean, the level of detail you clearly got into just with Alcatraz alone, let alone the other settings for the book, I mean, what was the big challenge in pulling all this together and not making this book be 1,300 pages or something?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it was a challenge because I've written much longer books in the past, and, you know, I tend to write two or three stories in one and treat them as a braid that kind of weaves together as it get closer to the conclusion. And in this case, I had actually thought about writing a present day and a past story, a dual timeline at the same time. And ultimately, when I looked at this story, and when you've got, you know, such meaty settings like Brooklyn in the 20s and, you know, et cetera, and all the things we talked about, the vaudeville burlesque circuits, et cetera, and Alcatraz, I realized that as a reader, those were the chapters I would be skipping to. I would skip past the present day and get back to the good stuff, you know, in the past, and realize that that is then the story I wanted to write was all completely in the past.
Well, there is a major plot twist at the end of the book. So were those planned originally, or did they sort of come out of the writing? I'm always curious about the process, too, about the things that end up as eureka moments to you versus the things that you're carefully plotting down as you go.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm definitely more of a plotter. I used to be an event planner. I used to do 14 weddings a summer. So I love my Post-its, let me tell you that. So I tend to like to know what's coming next. But in this case, because I was under a bit of a tight deadline because of a lot of other crazy things that had happened in life that slowed things down. I'm also a mother of two young boys, 9 and 12 years old, so they keep me busy and always trying to find that juggle the balance of that. When I sat down to actually write the book, then I knew that I really had to buckle down and write pretty fast. I usually know the beginning, a little bit of the middle, and the ending, and I think that's common for a lot of writers. In this case, I thought I kind of had a vague sense of the ending, but not really. But I didn't have the luxury of sitting down and either having a panic attack because I didn't know or figuring it out before I sat down to write. And so I knew the gist of the story, and I'm proud of this book in so many ways, and especially as a writer. I felt like I forced myself to grow. A deadline will make you do that. But I felt like I was driving in a fog where I could see about 10 feet ahead of me. And that was about it. And I had to trust, because of past books, I knew I could get it done. I would have to get it done one way or another, and I could panic or not. And so I decided just to keep driving and trust that when I got 10 feet further, I would be able to see 10 feet again. And thankfully, my husband, every Friday night, we would sit with a glass of wine after the kids went to bed, and he really helped me brainstorm more than any book ever before and said, okay, where are we now? What characters have you got? And he really helped ground me and try to keep me really grounded in reality of what would be realistic and plausible at the time. And the characters, like you said earlier, being character-driven as well, even though you have all these exciting things happening, of plot twists and whatnot, of being grounded in those characters. So when I finally got to answer your question, when it got to that, some of those major plot twists at the end, I didn't know they were coming, which is what's so fun. When I came to those realizations, I thought, oh my gosh, it's been here the whole time and I didn't know it. I then hope that readers feel the same.
Your husband sounds like a great help, sitting you down and saying, okay, what happened at the office this week?
Yeah, it It really was. And we've never really been like that with many of the books. Only when I had a real problem and said, what do you think of this? You know, my Midwest character is this grandmother back in, you know, the 40s, because my husband is from the Midwest and has those grandparents. And so we would brainstorm that. But this is the first time it really, I felt like he kind of, you know, we were in it as a team. You know, really brainstorm those. And then I would go back to work on Monday morning and write Monday through Friday and then write those five chapters and then sit down Friday night with a glass of wine and say, all right, I'm in the fog, 10 feet ahead. What comes next?
Wow, that is a process. Shanley Keegan himself, was he based primarily on any historical figure, anybody you knew?
No, just really, like I said, a collection. You know, there were bits and pieces of that I'd heard of my grandfather's father and his father before that. And so having these heavy Irish brogues was very fun. Being able to form Shanley also was really helpful in that I connected with people in Ireland. So friends of friends that lived in areas that I was interested in. Places that didn't have necessarily a really heavy brogue, but could be in villages and areas with educated parents, in this case, you know, Shanley's father, that he was raised with, is a doctor. And so I like the fact that this kid was very intelligent, and yet he was scraping by in pubs when you see him, and it's not really who he is. So I got to draw on the slang and the words and the cultures of some of these people that I know of that actually do live in County Waterford.
Given your organization and work ethic, I can't imagine you're not at least pulling tidbits together for a next novel.
I'm thinking about it. I'm surviving the holidays, as we all are right now, hoping that we don't kill, you know, family members before we hit New Year's. But other than that, I'm leaning toward a story that probably has to do with New Orleans next, another historical. It's one of those places with the settings that I know I could write in a heartbeat because I love that city so much.
Huh. Okay, good times ahead. The book now is called The Edge of Lost. It is the fourth novel by Christina McMorris, who lives in the Portland area. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure.
All right, take care. Good luck with the holidays.
You too.